This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neal Conan. Heads of state from around the world are meeting in New York for the 60th anniversary of the United Nations. This morning, President Bush addressed the General Assembly.
In each year of history, the human spirit has been challenged by the forces of darkness and chaos. Some challenges are the acts of nature. Others are the works of man. This organization was convened to meet these challenges by harnessing the best instincts of humankind, the strength of the world, united in common purpose. With courage and conscience, we will meet our responsibilities to protect the lives and rights of others. And when we do, we will help fulfill the promise of the United Nations and ensure that every human being enjoys the peace and the freedom and the dignity our Creator intended for all.
As the UN works to set goals for dealing with terrorism, AIDS, poverty, and human rights, charges of corruption in the international organization continue. The relationship between the U.S. and the UN has often had acrimonious overtones in recent years. Today, we'll discuss how the superpower that helped establish the United Nations has become its greatest critic. What do you think of the U.S. attitude toward the UN? Have your own views of the UN changed over the years? Do you think it's lived up to its idealistic goals of helping to promote world peace and human rights? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Later in the program, we'll talk about today's Senate confirmation hearings for Chief Justice of the United States. But now, the UN meeting in New York. Howard LaFranchi is covering the latest developments there as foreign affairs correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, and he joins us by phone from the UN headquarters. Thanks so much for being with us now.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
President Bush spoke before the General Assembly today, as we just heard. How was that speech received?
Well, I think generally well. Most importantly, I'd say that there was a sigh of relief here at the United Nations that there was an agreed document that twins UN reform with development goals. Because up until yesterday afternoon, it wasn't even certain that there was going to be agreement on a document, and so when finally agreement was reached, I think there was a feeling of kind of a relaxing of concerns, because this, after all, is the UN that was so brought down by the debate over going to war in Iraq, and I think there was a feeling that if there were two defeats in a row like that, that there was uncertainty that the institution could even live through two such setbacks.
Now, the president spoke about terrorism today. That was one of the issues that he discussed. What other things did he talk about? And was there any particular response to any of his points, either positive or negative?
Well, he did talk about the need for development and for wealthy countries to continue supporting development of poorer countries, but he placed a particular emphasis, as he often has, on the need for countries to use aid wisely, that it is primarily through their governance that they will develop. And so there was a particular emphasis on that. He also talked about the importance of helping Iraq become a democracy. And then in a later special session of the Security Council, he, along with the other Security Council members, addressed the problem of terrorism specifically. He also referred to Katrina and the aftermath of Katrina in his statement to the General Assembly.
Now, the document that you mentioned earlier, dealing with both reform and development goals, the final document was scaled down from the original proposal. Let's talk first about what got into it, and then maybe we can talk about what got left out. First of all, what's in there?
Well, it's a very general document. It's 35 pages long, and the original idea is that it would be something of a grand bargain that would bring together what the developing countries wanted, which was more emphasis on development goals, with what developed or wealthy countries were looking for, which was more emphasis on security, on security issues, on reforming UN management, and also on improving global human rights records. And so the idea was to that there would be trade-offs on those, and that everybody would get something what they wanted. What it ended up being was really quite a watered-down document that talks in broad generalities about all of these issues, but very few specifics.
What got left out in particular? Any particularly contentious issue?
You could take a couple of examples. For example, on human rights, I think many people know of the Commission on Human Rights, the UN's commission, that that has a very poor reputation, is generally discredited. Very often countries that are some of the worst human rights violators in the world end up on that commission because it is through regional and rotating memberships that you get on that council. And so basically what has happened, as Kofi Annan has said and others, that countries aspire to get on so that they can, in fact, avoid being taken to task for their human rights records. And so the idea was to get rid of that commission, replace it with a smaller council. Originally, there was language that would have meant for quite strict rules in terms of membership, who could actually be on. All of those specifications were withdrawn, and what's left is a statement that says there will be a Human Rights Council, and it will be up to the General Assembly to decide how that will take place. So there will be a lot of negotiating left to go on that. On development goals, for example, there was a strong desire to see a reference to the so-called Millennium Development Goals, which countries had agreed to just 5 years ago. And the United States did not want any specific, at first didn't want any specific reference to those goals, preferring something much more general. Finally went along with mentioning those words, Millennium Development Goals, but still insisting that any specific goals be kept out. And so those specific goals, for example, that wealthy countries would continue to work towards putting 0.7% of their GNP towards development, that kind of specific goal was kept out of the text.
In the end, did U.S. Ambassador John Bolton express satisfaction with this final document?
Yeah, Bolton said he was satisfied. He said that it was neither the alpha nor the omega of UN reform, and that things would continue from here. But there was reason for him to be satisfied. For some of the reasons we've talked about. I mean, he as much as he and the United States wanted some specifics on human rights, for example, they very much wanted to keep out like the specific development goals or specific reference to other international agreements that the U.S. is opposed to, for example, the Kyoto Greenhouse Gas Accords or the International Criminal Court. And those were originally referred to in the text. Those were taken out. So in that sense, I think Ambassador Bolton sees himself as probably having defended American interests as he sees them pretty well.
All right. Well, thanks so much for being with us today, Howard.
Thank you.
Foreign Affairs correspondent Howard LaFranchi is covering the UN meetings in New York for the Christian Science Monitor, and he joined us by phone from the UN headquarters. The tense relationship between the U.S. and the UN has a long and varied history. With us now to trace back the seeds of discord is Anne Florini, Foreign Policy Studies Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institute in Washington, D.C. She joins us in our studio. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, the United States helped make the UN possible. So let's go back to that beginning. What was the attitude in this country towards the UN at the beginning?
At the beginning, it was a very, very positive attitude. Coming out of World War II, there was a very strong feeling that this could not happen again, that we needed a way for the nations of the world to come together and make sure that a major world war never happened again.
So this was seen as an institution that really could be instrumental in bringing about or maintaining world peace.
It was very much seen as an institution that could maintain world peace. Remember, this was before the start of the Cold War. It was before it was clear that relations with the then Soviet Union would be as hostile as they became. So there were very high hopes for the institution.
Were there always skeptics?
There were always skeptics. And there has been a strain of skepticism about the UN from the very beginning, because there's a strong strain of isolationism in the United States. Always has been, probably always will be. People who think that any international organization represents a threat to U.S. sovereignty and to U.S. freedoms.
So there's that fear of internationalism by its that somehow U.S. interests will not necessarily be met by the United Nations. That's been there for a while.
That's been there from the very beginning. It seems to be a fear that the United Nations is or could be much, much more than it actually is. What it really is an instrument of its, what's now 191 member governments. There's a fear that it could turn into something like a world government where these faceless bureaucrats would start telling the U.S. what to do and the U.S. would have no recourse. That's extremely far from the reality, but it is a deep-seated minority, but deep-seated opinion in the United States.
Some people may not remember the time when it was just common for young kids to, on Halloween, to collect money for UNICEF, for example. Often kids participated in United Nations, model United Nations forums. So there was at one time, and some of that still is around, but not quite so much, there was this feeling of participation in the United Nations, a kind of community participation in it.
Well, there's still a fair amount of that. I mean, there are still kids collecting for UNICEF. There are still model UNs all over the country. There are organizations like the United Nations Association of the U.S. that are supporting the work of the United Nations. It's probably less widespread than it used to be, but there's also still very clearly a strain in the United States that's very pro-UN.
We're talking about changing attitudes toward the UN. Did you participate in a model UN as a student, and have your views of the UN changed? If so, why? Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. We'll continue this discussion after a short break. If you want to send us an email, the address TOTN@NPR.org. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're talking about the relationship between the U.S. and the United Nations, its history, and present conflicts. Our guest is Anne Florini, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. We'd like to hear your view of the U.N. and how it may have changed over time. You're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. That's 800-989-8255. And our email address, totn@npr.org. Anne, when did... We were saying before the break that early on attitudes towards the UN, generally speaking within the United States, were favorable. When did things begin to change, and when did the relationship start becoming more contentious?
Well, the relationship has been contentious on and off from the beginning. There was a fairly fundamental shift, I think, in the 60s and 70s as decolonization happened, and a whole bunch of places that had been colonies became independent countries and became members of the United Nations. And the tone of debate within the United Nations began to change. The U.S., that had gotten used to having pretty automatic majorities in the General Assembly, didn't have them anymore. And especially those people who'd been prepared to be pretty hostile to the idea of the U.N. in the first place found this very difficult to accept. By the 1980s, particularly in the U.S. Congress, you found some very strong outright hostility to the U.N., which got to the point in the mid-1980s of threatening to withhold half of our required dues payments to the organization.
Why did the U.S. make that decision about not paying its dues? And what was the effect of that within the U.N.?
Well, the effects were very challenging for the United Nations, to put it mildly, and probably weren't very good for the United States in the long run. It started off in the mid-1980s as a way of dealing with Congress's frustration over the fact that they weren't getting the kinds of reforms that they thought they should be getting in the United Nations, particularly over who had control of the budget. By that point, poor countries that together contributed a very small share of the budget had a two-thirds majority in the General Assembly. That meant they could determine what the budget would be and then require the U.S. and the other major contributors to pay up. the U.S. was very concerned, and Congress especially, was very concerned that they were going to really abuse that. And so the U.S. passed a law saying that if the United Nations did not institute a system of what's called weighted voting, where we would have a vote proportional to not the fact that we were one member country, but to how much we were paying, that we'd cut paying our dues. We didn't actually get weighted voting. What we got was a system of consensus decision making, so that at least we could be pretty sure that we weren't going to get huge budgets forced down our throat. But from then on, Congress just kept whittling away at the UN budget, at what they were willing to contribute. And over time, we built up a huge amount of arrears because we are the largest contributor. It created very, very bad feeling at the United Nations, not only among our rivals, but among our allies as well. It was seen as a very heavy-handed approach.
So are the after effects of that still being felt now?
The after effects are very definitely still being felt now. Part of the problem with what's been happening this week at the UN is when John Bolton went up there in August, he went in with a fairly heavy-handed approach. He was not happy with how the negotiations were going, what was being put into the document the world leaders were to sign, and he was not subtle in the way that he made his displeasure clear. The reaction of a lot of people, diplomats at the UN, was, here goes the United States again, throwing its weight around, no respect for other people's opinions or the work that's been done to date, no respect for what other people's interests might be. If you couple that with the fact that Congress, the House of Representatives, has already passed a bill threatening to withhold half our dues again if the UN doesn't institute a very long list of very detailed and, in some cases, unworkable reforms that some in Congress want to see, we're going to cut our dues in half again. A version of that bill is now in the Senate. That has people in New York extremely upset, including the people we most need to work with there.
We're talking about the complex and often contentious relationship between the United States and the UN. My guest is Anne Florini, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution. And we are taking your calls. The number is 1-800-989-8255. We're going to go to Linda, and she's in Roseville, California. Hi, Linda.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks. Go ahead.
I had a chance to go by the United Nations during my summer vacation. I was in Switzerland, and they were closed for tourists, but I looked through the gate, and I was just overwhelmed by all the flags that really were representative of all the countries and the nations making up the United Nations, and it made me realize that it truly isn't just all about us. It's not just about the U.S., that so many other countries are involved, and that the people who are part of the United Nations, everyone does have a voice. And like I said, I was just so impressed when I just saw the building, the structure, the flags, and just the true representation.
So it gave you a sense of where the U.S. fits in the rest of the world and made you, gave you a little insight into what the organization's about, you're saying.
Right, and you're right, how we fit in, because it wasn't our flag in the middle and all the other flags around us. We were right in line, whether it was, whether how people were, the flags were posted according to when they were admitted in the nations or whether it was in alphabetical order. But our flag didn't necessarily just stand out and make it look like that we're in charge. We're just part of a larger group.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Linda.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the a big issue that that keeps coming up over and over again that many in the United States, critics of the UN, are concerned about is the need for reform within the United Nations. What has Kofi Annan done to address those concerns?
Kofi Annan has been working on internal management kind of reform since he became Secretary General in 1997. Almost as soon as he got into office, he started taking a handful of steps that he could undertake under his own authority, although he didn't necessarily push hard enough to make sure that they were being implemented through the system. But a great deal of what's wrong with the internal management structure at the UN is beyond his authority. There's not much he can do about it. The problem is that all those 191 member countries whose flags your listener saw have created a system of micromanagement to such a degree that it's hard to imagine any U.S. government agency or corporation or any other entity in the world being willing to work under those conditions. Right now, the General Assembly has complete control over every detail of the budget, over every person who is hired within the system. If the Secretary General is given a new set of priorities by the General Assembly and told, for example, that he now has to start working on counterterrorism in addition to everything else that he's doing, he can't take 50 people out of the library system or out of the conference planning system or wherever they may be and move them over. He has to get specific approval from the General Assembly for each and every line item, each and every post in the system. It's very hard to see how you manage a system like that. So part of what was supposed to happen in New York this week was agreement to give him much more authority.
One other thing. I attended the UN Population Conference in Cairo in the mid-90s, and I was struck by when you go to one of those conferences, you see those flags become people. And you realize how many people from how many different parts of the world are trying to come to some agreement on a document about prioritizing an issue such as population, the population issue in that case. Finally, they do, after much talking and seems to me going over with a fine-tooth comb every single word that's in the document, and you begin to wonder whether it means anything in the end. And that was my question at the end of that. How does anybody know? You spend all this time coming with this document. What does it really mean in the end? I wonder if that's part of what people wonder about, whether the UN is really being effective.
Some of the documents mean absolutely nothing. In fact, a large number of them mean pretty much nothing. Some of them really do have significant implications for how the world is going to function and whether people who are now suffering from extreme poverty or from the effects of war are going to be helped. It's important to realize that the United Nations isn't just a talk shop. It started off as primarily a talk shop, and it still has that very important function, but it does a great deal more as well. It's, in fact, one of the reasons that Kofi Annan has been pushing so hard for this week's summit to result in a grand bargain, as your reporter mentioned, is that the nature of what the United Nations is has fundamentally changed in the last couple of decades. It isn't just a place where you bring diplomats together to come out with documents, although that's still an important part of it. What it is now is overwhelmingly an operational agency. It is doing something like 17 or 18 military peacekeeping missions around the world right now, with something like over 70,000 troops involved. It's overseeing the tsunami relief effort. It is doing so many operational activities that this particular outcome document that's been being negotiated over the last few days was supposed to help recreate the United Nations in such a way that it could take on those operational responsibilities. And it has fallen far short of what was needed.
We're talking about the United Nations and particularly the U.S. relationship with the United Nations. If you'd like to join the discussion, the number is 1-800-989-8255. Calls for U.N. reform have echoed across Capitol Hill for years, as we've been discussing. And with us now to discuss that is Brett Schaefer. He's a research fellow in international regulatory affairs with the Heritage Foundation, and he joins us from their studios here in Washington, D.C. Thanks for being with us, Mr. Schaefer.
Thank you, and hello, Ann.
Hello, Brett.
Let's talk about, we've heard a lot, for instance, about corruption in the food for the oil for food for oil program. How extensive are the internal problems in the UN?
Well, I think the Volcker Commission report reported quite accurately on that when it said that basically there were very few, and what controls were available were inadequate. Saddam Hussein was able to profit from the oil for food program, both through contractual kickbacks and also through sanctions busting. And the end result was a very ineffectual program.
Is that the main reform that's needed? What other reforms are needed?
I mean, the oil for food scandal has gotten a lot of the headlines, and deservedly so. It's a very disappointing program and obviously open to considerable abuse. But it was a one-time affair. It's now ended. And what we need to focus on, I think, is how to reform the United Nations in general to increase the transparency, the accountability within the system itself, to increase the management of the organization, management capabilities of the organization, and introduce a level of effectiveness that, quite frankly, isn't there right now.
A bipartisan task force headed by a Republican, the former Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, and former Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell, they released a report detailing some reforms for the UN last June. What are some of the things that they pointed out needs to be done?
Well, Anne was actually participating with me in that, and I think your guest later on, Lee Feinstein, as well. And it was a remarkable document in that it brought together folks from varying political spectrum, or from the spectrum all across the U.S. political dynamics, and we reached agreement on a number of different issues. First and foremost, we need to have a line of responsibility and accountability within the organization. The secretariat needs to have a single, very senior official in charge of the daily operations and fulfilling the role of chief operational officer. Right now, there is no such person responsible for the daily operations of the organization. And so if there are failures, there's no one to hold up responsible. You know, following the Volcker Commission report, Kofi Annan said that he takes responsibility for the failures of that program. And yet then again, he sort of dispersed blame all the way around. And it's kind of questionable how you can accept responsibility when you don't really do so. There needs, within the UN system itself, there needs to be someone that you can point to and hold up and ask questions and said, what happened?
Brett Schaefer is a research fellow at the Heritage Foundation, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Some other reforms that are necessary. There needs to be independent oversight of the UN and its performance. We advocated an independent oversight board outside of the institution itself, and with the power to not only authorize investigations but to set the budget for the equivalent of the Internal Inspector General unit there. That reform was not adopted in the Millennium Summit document, nor were any of the other major recommendations that we recommended, such as an Office of Ethics, such as financial disclosure of UN officials, such as merit-based hiring rather than what is predominantly the case now, geographical or representational hiring for other reasons other than merit.
All right, let's take a call now. We have Luke in Washington, D.C. On the line. Hi, Luke. Luke, are you there? Have we lost Luke? I think we have. Let me ask you, Anne, while we're waiting for another caller, would you say there's general agreement on what we've just been discussing with Brett Schaefer about the reforms that are needed within the UN?
Well, certainly between me and Brett there is, because we were both involved in the writing of that report. And I think more broadly in the American political system, there's very strong agreement that these are the kinds of reforms that are needed. You need oversight, accountability, performance standards, ethics standards. Some of those the Secretary General has been pushing the last few months, the things he can do on his own. He's gotten a little more effective about that. But as Brett said, nothing in the outcome document reflects all of that. At the international level, though, there is much less consensus about this, which I find shocking given how clearly the Volcker Commission's reports have laid out just how flawed the internal systems are at the United Nations. Part of it is a recognition that this is very important to the U.S., and there is a number of people who do not want to do anything the U.S. wants to do. Part of it is some of the specific recommendations are seen as a power grab by the U.S. For example, the idea of having a chief operating officer, it's assumed that that person would be an American and that this is the way that America wants to take over the U.N. It's a fairly silly response, but it is the response.
All right, let's see if we can get another call in. Mark in Cincinnati, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead, Mark.
When I hear the Bush administration go on about the corruption in the United Nations, I think there are points to be made, but I think they're maybe not the best candidates to make that. I think the U.S., particularly the Bush administration, but also Democratic administrations, have relied heavily on unilateralism, and they ignore U.N. resolutions when we don't like them. They've recently violated international law by invading Iraq, and through the preemptive war, and just a policy of arrogance, both internationally and domestically, which I find utterly frustrating, and I get very upset when people refer to the United States as we when it's not, as opposed to individual administrations' choices.
All right, Mark, I'd like to get a response from Brett Schaefer to some of the points that you've raised. Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for your call. Mr. Schaefer, we've been talking about reform, but unilateralism versus multilateralism is also part of this discussion. Mm-hmm. I'd just like to hear you address that question.
Absolutely. I guess the point I would like to make is that the United Nations is not the only multilateral forum out there. We have NATO, we have PSI, which is a Proliferation Security Initiative, which is an ad hoc coalition. We have other international bodies, which the U.S. is not part of, ASEAN. You have the African Union and other international bodies that can work in a multilateral fashion, not through the United Nations. And I guess my answer here is that I think that the United Nations is a good vehicle to work with on certain problems, but not necessarily the ideal vehicle on every single issue. And we need to be open to the idea that perhaps the United Nations is not the first option, but perhaps a second best option. And we need to consider that.
All right. Well, thanks so much for being with us, Mr. Schaefer.
You're welcome.
Brett Schaefer is a research fellow in international regulatory affairs with the Heritage Foundation, and he joins us from their studios here in Washington, D.C. I just want to read a quick email. We're going to have to get out of this shortly, but my concern with the U.N., this email says, is that it seeks to present an image of itself as the embodiment of world democracy. It is, of course, not that, but rather a democracy of governments of every color, including many run by dictators. Anne Florini, maybe we'll take up that email and other questions when we return after a short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today we're talking about the relationship between the U.S. and the U.N. and what steps each could take to work together better. Our guests are Anne Florini of the Brookings Institution and joining us now, Lee Feinstein. He's a senior fellow in U.S. foreign policy and international law with the Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks for being with us, Lee.
Happy to join you.
I wonder, Lee, if you could address the question we just received in an email first, if you have an answer for this. I'll repeat it for you in case you didn't hear it from Eric in Kansas. My concern with the U.N. is that it seeks to present an image of itself as the embodiment of world democracy. It is, of course, not that, but rather a democracy of governments of every color, including many run by dictators. That's one of the criticisms that people make of the UN, that within the organization there are leaders who are dictators, who are maybe ruthless leaders, may violate human rights, and yet are talking about issues such as human rights with other nations. How can you address that kind of criticism? What's your response to that?
Well, it's a valid criticism, and at least one of those countries sits on the Security Council and has a veto. So it's a real problem. And the interesting thing is that it's a problem that I think is acknowledged and recognized, in at least in the U.S. debate, across political lines. So the question is, how do you, there's utility to having a universal organization. There are no membership criteria for joining the U.N. so long as you're a sovereign state. You don't have to be a democracy to join. But there is an issue of the legitimacy of the institution. And it seems to me what one wants to do is set some standards for different types of institutions within the UN. So, you know, a good example is the Human Rights Commission, which hopefully as a result of this agreement today in New York is now abolished. That commission has done a number of good things, but over the years, countries have joined primarily to shield themselves from international criticism rather than to advance human rights principles and to protect the oppressed. And so what one hopes will happen is that this new Human Rights Council, which is being created, will actually be populated by countries that are themselves supporters and promoters of human rights, and that it will exclude other nations.
Our last guest, Brett Schaefer, was saying that for those who believe in multilateralism in our foreign policy, there are other organizations besides the UN. So what's the purpose of the UN, and why is it important for the U.S.? Why is it in the U.S. interest to participate in negotiations at the UN, in the meetings going on there in New York right now, for instance?
Well, you know, first of all, you don't often negotiate with your friends. You're often negotiating with your adversaries. And so the fact that the UN is a universal organization gives you an opportunity to deal with countries who don't agree with you about things and who would, in fact, have the potential to be adversaries or are adversaries. So, you know, that's just a fundamental principle of diplomacy. If you only talk to your friends, you wouldn't accomplish some of the goals that you seek. More broadly, I think the question is, do you want to create some competitor institutions to both force the UN to be more responsive and to get some of the things accomplished that you may want to do elsewhere? An organization of 191 countries may not be the best place to do business on all issues. So, you know, one idea that people have discussed, including in this task force that Brett, Anne, and I served on as experts, although no one endorsed it, was, you know, the whole notion of getting the democracies to work together much better, both inside the UN and outside the UN, so that, for example, if Americans and Europeans were able to work very effectively inside the UN, it would be a lot easier to accomplish reforms within the UN. But in the absence of genuine transatlantic cooperation on these issues, it allows the spoilers to win.
All right, let's see if we can get a call in. Jeff in Florida, go ahead.
Yeah, I just finished actually reading a book about Woodrow Wilson trying to form the League of Nations, and I don't see any difference or distinction between what happened then and what happens now. The international view seems impossible when you've got nations that are insisting on their sovereignty. So how do you align those two bipolar issues when you've got nationalism versus internationalism, especially as far as enforcement is concerned?
Well, Lynn, if you'd like me to jump
in. Yes, go ahead, Lee.
This is the difficult issue. You know, the founding principle of the UN is this idea of sovereign equality of nations, that all nations are equal under the law, and also this idea that what happens inside a country's borders is nobody else's business. And I think increasingly what we're finding is that that idea is beginning to fade. And today we have a good example of that, because this 35-page document, which is very bland and has lots of UN speak and is hard to wade through, has some really important concepts, ideas, and agreements buried inside of it. And one of them is this whole notion of a responsibility to protect. And what it says is that the idea of sovereignty not only confers rights, it also creates responsibilities and obligations for states. And the first most fundamental responsibility is that a nation's leaders have a responsibility to protect their citizens from grave harm and not themselves to engage in atrocities. And furthermore, if those governments can't protect their own citizens or won't, that other countries have an obligation to do something about it. This is a really important concept, because it goes against this traditional notion of sovereignty, and it basically takes an excuse away from the Chinese and others who say, hey, listen, that's none of your business. The internal affairs of another country are only the business of that country.
Well, to me, and that seems to be what happens with an international body. When that international body is ineffective, then you've got someone like the United States, for whether you consider those reasons right or wrong, take an active participation in what happens in Iraq. And my feeling is, a lot of people are complaining. They're saying the United States has no business to do that. But I think the argument would be the same if an international body came in and did the same thing. You know, they would say, well, you don't have business to do anything in our country. It's our country.
All right. Thanks for your call, Jeff. I'm going to ask Anne Florini to join in responding to this caller's comments.
Yeah, I agree with what Lee said, but I think there's also another issue, which is that an awful lot of issues aren't national interests versus international interests. There are issues where the interests are very much common. We're all better off if we can find ways of working out solutions to things like global pandemics, environmental degradation, international terrorism, which is clearly something that no single nation state can deal with on its own. The United Nations is, in some cases, ideally suited to those kinds of big, broad issues that involve all of us. You still have to do hard negotiations over who's going to pay what share of what cost and figuring out exactly what to do. But the basic interests are often common ones rather than adversarial ones.
All right. Lee and Anne, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Anne Florini is Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution, Senior Fellow in Foreign Policy Studies. She joined me here in the studio. And Lee Feinstein is a Senior Fellow in U.S. Foreign Policy and International Law with the Council on Foreign Relations. And he joined us from his office in Washington, D.C.